He is here for one of his two appearances in December. He is the great Arlo. Originally, he was going to be on three times in December, but he's blowing me off December 31st. He came in and informed me today that he has placed me high atop the pay no mind list on December 31st. No, I'm just, right. I'm just kidding.
I'm going to be gone, gone, gone.
I was thinking to myself, who doesn't want to hang out with a Carino on December 31st? Come on. No, all seriousness, it's good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, too.
How was your Thanksgiving?
Well, I'll tell you, we started off with one plan and ended up with another plan. So we ended up having two Thanksgivings in one day. We were invited after we had all of our plans, and the meal was underway and all that kind of stuff for noon, and then we were invited to join a family here in Milbank at their Thanksgiving at 3 o'clock. So we had our turkey at noon, and we had their turkey around 4 o'clock. So needless to say, I was a little turkeyed out.
Ooh, that food coma was probably something I can only imagine after two Thanksgiving meals.
But it was fun. Yeah. You know, our family was in Fort Pierre, or Pierre, Fort Pierre, our oldest daughter and her family. That was really their family gathering, so that was fine. Our other daughter, our younger daughter, wasn't able to come anywhere, do anything, because they work for the post office and had to work on Thursday and Friday, and, you know, they're on a 6-day week, sometimes a 7. So that didn't, you know, wasn't going to work out on a Thursday for them. So we thought, Paul and I thought, well, you know, we've done this before. We're on our own. That's okay, you know. We got a turkey and did you know, had everything that we were planning, and then this invitation came that I guess we just hadn't thought about it, and they hadn't either, and things with this family sometimes is a little bit of spur of the moment, which was fun. That's okay, we do that too, and so that was how we ended up with our second of Thanksgiving. So it really was great fun to have, in effect, a family to be with, I suppose you could say, on that day. So that's what it was. That's what it was like.
Good.
What about yours?
We went to the good folks at the pump here in Milbank. We're having a big Thanksgiving gathering.
That's right.
So I thought to myself, what a perfect opportunity to help out the Cancer Walk, because they were taking a free will donation. They had a big, I don't even know what you call it, barrel of cash that they were given. There's tons of money in there to go to the Cancer Walk. So, yeah, everybody chipped in. So, yeah, a lot of people went to that. It was utterly delicious. It was fantastic. Okay. I stayed away from turkey. The older I get, the less I want to eat turkey. I'm not a big turkey eater, so I chose the ham with the fixins. Okay. They even had macaroni and cheese, which
macaroni and cheese on Thanksgiving.
Now you laugh now, but let me tell you this, my friend. We had a little, probably about a week before Thanksgiving. Kim and I were talking, and I think in 6 states, macaroni and cheese was listed as the most favorite side. It's real big. Macaroni and cheese is huge in the South for Thanksgiving. Absolutely enormous in the South for Thanksgiving. So they had macaroni and cheese because it's catered by Dakota Butcher. And yeah, so I ate there. I had a piece of cheesecake. Then I went home and laid into a food coma. So we helped off the Cancer Walk. We got to eat. We didn't have to clean up.
Yeah,
that was good because it's just the two of us. Yeah.
And you got to participate in a food source or a food type that is sweeping the nation.
Yes.
In the southern part of this nation.
That's right. Exactly. So it's a win-win-win situation all the way around. We got to eat, had a great meal, helped out the Cancer Walk, and didn't have tons of cleanup to do, which neither my wife or I wanted to do.
Okay, well, we're still eating turkey.
Exactly. that's kind of what we wanted to avoid, yeah, as far as that goes.
This year we bought a smoked turkey, and then the family that we joined, they also had a smoked turkey. So I was like, oh, what's it, how did smoked turkey all of a sudden become the thing? It wasn't the thing. We should have had mac and cheese.
That's right. Exactly. Right.
So next year we'll change that. We'll,
there you go.
I can wait a year for mac and cheese.
So in my travels, as I am a man of the streets, going through the mean streets of Milbank, I'm often asked questions that I don't have the answers to, because I really don't know much of anything. So I always put the questions in the back of my mind for different guests who we have on. And one of the questions that I got relatively recently, it was actually a few months ago, but I don't remember, is do you do any winterization in any of like the museums or the buggy museums? Do you have to winterize them at all? And I thought to myself, well, it's not a boat, but I'll go ahead and ask Arlo.
Well, yes. Okay. Good question. The in Milbank, the Dolan Justice is a new building, you know, new. It's only, it's 10 years old. It's 9 years old. We completed construction in the end of 2015. But there we have, of course, a heat pump, and so you have cooling and heating and just a matter of a thermostat. In the Carnegie Library building, which is a historical museum, there we had a more traditional furnace for years and years. Well, this year it finally quit. So we ended up putting a heat pump there, and we installed that this year. So there we had the ductwork. We had air conditioning before too. But when the system fails, you upgrade. So we did that, and we have heating and cooling, and we maintain heat in that building. We shut the water off. We decided we really didn't need water, so the city came a couple. maybe 3 years ago. And, of course, in that case, you're dealing with a water line that's 100-and-some years old, so getting it shut off was, a major accomplishment, we felt, because we hadn't done anything with it in any of the time I'd been involved. So we shut it off, and so we don't heat it for that reason. But we do heat it because, again, it's a very old building, built in 1905 and that sort of thing. So you need to maintain it. We feel to maintain the integrity of this old building, we have to heat it. You don't have to cool it, but you do have to heat it. Cooling, of course, is a matter of convenience and comfort. Now, in Stockholm, the Buggy Museum, back here in Milbank, the Victorian Hall, or the historical house in the Amsden School, never been heated for decades.
Okay.
They sit on a slab. They don't have, we do have water. No, we don't have water, neither one. We just have water available outside from a hose. So that doesn't, So they've never been heated or cooled. There is deterioration, frankly, but it's slow, and we've maintained both of the buildings. In terms of maintenance, we've put a new roof on both of them over the, we did the roof 2 or 3 years ago, 2 years ago, on the historical house, and we painted both. So they look nice. They have a roof. They're in good shape. But again, they don't, they're not winterized. You just close the door and, make sure the lock works. That's the end of it as far as the getting it ready. In Stockholm, we're actually working there right now, and we'll be there, this morning again, because we're painting this covered wagon. That's going to become our chuck wagon. So in the Ag Museum, the newest, where we renovated a building, this year, during the winter months, actually starting in January of 2024, there we put a heater in so we can heat it. The Buggy Museum's not heated, never will be heated. The buildings are heavily insulated. Today, well, it's not quite as cold, but we're coming off a number of, cold days. We'll check the temperature just out of curiosity more than anything in the Buggy Museum, but I'm going to guess it's still going to be about 50, maybe 45. The other building will be probably, we turned the furnace on yesterday or the heater on yesterday because we're going to be working there. So we can maintain a 60 to 65 temp in that one with a very small heater. Again, that's all we do. When we're done, we'll turn that heater off and we'll do nothing further with either of those buildings. None of the other buildings that are over there have ever been heated. They've just been just as they are. You know, we lock, shut the door, lock it, and away we go for the season.
Gotcha.
So that's pretty much the way how we do it. We can, if somebody wants to visit a museum here in Milbank, we have two of them that would be very easy to warm up again. And, you know, if you know ahead of time, all you have to do is adjust the thermostat and away you go. So that's what we do.
There you go.
Okay.
Question answered by the man himself.
Yep.
So in the wintertime, we head into Christmas. Obviously, one of the cool things, well, you do many cool things. I just can't say that you just do one cool thing. Don't want to be insulting or anything. You do many cool things. I mean, you're getting a chuck wagon, for Pete's sakes.
We're building a chuck wagon.
Yeah, you're building a chuck wagon. How many entities build chuck wagons? I mean, come on.
I can tell you, none. That's a pretty simple answer to that
one. But you do. You know what, though? That's the great thing about you. You're always willing to try something different. You did the burger battle.
Yep, we did.
You did the burger battle. Now you're doing the chuck wagon. You're always throwing things out there.
Yep, we're trying to. The burger battle is fun, but it was so far out of our lane in reality you don't do anything for free, nothing, you know, it all costs money, which is fine. And the businesses that were involved all gained, something, some by it, you know. But for us, after I looked at it and thought about it, and again, our goal was to make people more aware of the, Buggy Museum and so forth. So, I think back then, this is a couple years ago now already, when we started this. I accomplished that goal. We also are a sponsor of the Snow Queen contest here in Milbank. So I don't know if you noticed that, whether that advertisement helped from your standpoint. Oh, did you see that? Well, maybe not. But anyway, we were. This is our second year. That's a big event, and I intend to continue to do that as a sponsor, which you know, again, it's a function of money. You contribute, you make a contribution, and in our case, we get our logo placed on the cover, and so many people come. The theater is filled. And people, if they're looking at the program, they look at it, and you accomplish the goal, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I want to do nothing more than that. You know, that's, you know, it's just, and I guess in terms of maybe advertising or making people aware, the visual part works pretty well, I think. So I think we're at a point, I believe in my mind, we're at a point where if in Grant County you don't know there's a Buggy Museum, in Stockholm, then you're not paying a whole lot of attention. And there isn't probably much I can do to improve that with a certain element. But most people otherwise are aware that there is. And so if you're going to do something or come, and if you're going to come, you're probably going to come because we do the buggy rides. Mm-hmm. Or I'm thinking, if you come now, what's this chuck wagon business all about? How's that going to work? We'll see. We'll see if that works. In that case, you're dealing with people that already live here in Grant County and Roberts County and Dual County and so forth. But the effort to broaden out, there we use the of course, Facebook, where, you know, we have our website and so forth. And that does work to a degree. We do draw people that see. But there's also a few other ways to do that. And it's... I need to get to work and do another one. We've done, each year we've done 500 pamphlets, and we're out of them again. So we put them in the visitor center. We put them here and there. We put them in motels. We just go around. We just leave them here and there, and they just disappear. So people do pick them up, do look at them and all that. So that's another avenue, you know, as far as, you know, getting the word out, I suppose you could say, or not getting the word out. I don't like that phrase, and I shouldn't have used it. But to continue to maintain awareness is really what I'm talking about.
What about, and I don't know if there's a cost associated with this, because I don't know enough about rest stops and visitor centers enough. What about, you know, well, you see some of the other visitors' places, visitor centers that you stop in on road trips and... what about placing stuff there, and is there a cost associated with that?
There's no cost. It's just a matter of getting accepted.
Okay.
And so they're all run by the South Dakota Department of Tourism. And the one up with Wilmot's a big one. A lot of people come there. The person that was in charge had, whether she imposed them or they were imposed, a big long list of conditions you had to meet and a process by which you had to follow. Okay, there's a new person, and we were able to give them in much easily this past year. So, yes, that's an avenue. It should be easy. It should be able to walk in. This is who I am. This is what I have. Can I put them here in the rack? I shouldn't have to go through a bunch of procedural activities.
Sure.
To prove who I am or whatever the problems are. I don't know. It's almost the same thing with South Dakota Department of Tourism. I haven't been able to even get listed, and I got to sit down and work at it again. But here we are. We're part of tourism in northeastern South Dakota. Why can't we get listed on the website that's out there? You know, and I've tried. Boy, I've tried.
Who do you talk to?
Not sure who I've talked to. You know, who do I talk to? I need to find out who the right person is. I haven't been able to get there.
Have you talked to Caitlin?
Caitlin, who?
Svensson?
Nope.
Okay. She comes on every month. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So what is she?
She is like one of the big wigs.
Okay.
So feel free to drop my name.
Caitlin Svensson. I'll do that.
I don't know if it'll do any good.
Yeah, maybe it will.
Give it a shot.
Well.
She seems to tolerate me. Just really all you can really ask for people.
Well,
you
know? If she does, that's good.
So there you go.
That's a huge mark in her favor.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, hey, let me talk about what we said we were going to talk about today a little bit. Okay.
And just so we know, I'll send her an email and our caliber copy with you.
Okay.
And I'll try to see if I can help
facilitate
you.
Facilitate that a little bit here.
I'll try to do what I can.
Fantastic. Fantastic. That's great. I'm glad I brought that up.
See, there you go.
That's been
I'm going to use my massive pull. All right, I don't have any pull with anything. But, yeah, I'll give it a shot.
You know. Well, you might have, though. You might be surprised at how much pull you do have.
I'll kind of look at it as I did my dating life before I got married. I'll have to deal with a lot of no's before you get to a yes.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, what you asked me to talk about today was this obsession, I suppose you could say, I had once upon a time when I lived in Pierre. And I have to confront the fact that I get excited about something, and I maintain that excitement in some cases for a long time, and I maintain it to a degree that most normal people would not pursue and get to that point. So I'll go back to about 1982, January 1st of 1982, Paula and I, she against her will. Absolutely, totally against her will. we bought a trailer park and a motel in Pierre. It was a 35-unit motel and an 18-unit trailer park, or 18-unit motel, 35 units. So with that, you get 35 families that have their mobile homes in your park, what has just become your park. One family was a guy, that guy and his wife. He'd just become the new Army recruiter in Milbank, or I mean in Pierre, Fort Pierre. So he'd been there for a few months, and I met him early on, met his wife, and she was obviously Asiatic, Korean, it turned out. Didn't really talk too much to him till we get to be spring, April, maybe very early May. He comes over and asks me, let's go bass fishing.
Okay.
And I was working so hard with, we already had 5 houses in town and I had a full-time job, and so I didn't have time to go fishing. But he said, look, you know, my wife really wants fish, some fish. I like to bass fish. So let's go see what we can find out in the, where we're going to go. And he said, let's go out to the Fort Pierre National Grasslands. Okay. Never been out there, even though I lived in Pierre for a few years at that point. So away we go. And of course I had a fishing background, so I wasn't, you know, I knew how to do that, but I'd been in Montana and Colorado where all of my fishing was trout at that point.
Okay.
So we were bass fishing and this was fun. Caught a lot of fish in this pond. And I knew I'd met his wife before. And so at one point I said, his name was Ed. I said, Ed, tell me a little bit about your wife. How'd you meet her? And he said, I bought her. And I went, really? What's that mean?
Interesting.
I paid $20 for her. He was in the Army in South Korea. And he thought he was buying entertainment for an evening, and he found out he was not buying just entertainment. He was actually buying a person from her dad. So he told me, I said, you know, I was like, okay. I said, then what? And he said, well, I went in to talk to my sergeant, you know, about what to do. And he said, well, you've got 2 choices. You know, you are in the Army and you've made this acquisition. He said, you either turn her back out in the street or you marry her. You know, it's only 2 choices. So he decided to marry her. So she became his wife. And then when he got brought stateside, brought back home, you know, here they were, you know, and she had not spoken a word of English, so she was learning and so forth, and she liked fish, so, and bass was what his answer was to that, and so I helped with that. Well, we maintained as long as they stayed there, and they stayed there for another year, about a year, and then he was a successful recruiter, so he got transferred somewhere else to some other spot. So I lost contact over time with him. But he triggered this thought about bass fishing because in the process, you know, I said, well, how do we, you know, and you know, how big a deal is this? And where do you go find more ponds and so forth? So he and I looked for a couple, and that was about all that was. But it triggered the interest on my part. In that process in 84, so this was 82 and 83, 84, I took the job as the principal of the Pyrenean Learning Center. In that process, one of our teachers, her had a husband who worked for South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks, and his name was George Vandell. And at that time, George was in a position as a researcher, I would guess would be the best way to look at it, a quasi-administrative job, as far as I could tell, where he worked with the Department of Fisheries, and likewise he worked with hunting, with deer populations, and elk populations, but primarily fishing. So I had started then, by that time, spending a little bit more time fishing, and was thinking, you know, there's all these ponds out here in this entity called the Fort Pierre National Grasslands, which actually is 120,000 acres, so it's a large piece of ground. Mm-hmm. And I was finding fish here and not finding fish there. But I wasn't really going at it too hard. But I'm out there wandering around in this in the grasslands, fishing, not talking to anybody really. I didn't really, you know, I couldn't, and, you know, this is, at that time, Pier and Fort Pier were fashioning themselves as the walleye capital of the world. They were bringing in all the tournaments and all the big guys and all that kind of stuff. Bass fishing was not on their radar.
What year was this again?
Well, we're into the 80s.
The 80s, okay.
The mid 80s. We're talking 84. I'm talking 84, 85.
Okay.
And in talking with George, since his wife worked for me, he said, and I asked, you know, said, well, what about the grasslands? Oh, boy, he says, we just don't know very much about what's out in the grasslands. We don't promote it. We don't not, you know, we just don't do anything with it. We don't have the manpower. We don't have, you know, the time and so forth to go out there and spend and learn about what's out there. Okay. So that set also the stage in my mind. And so I thought, well, we had divested ourselves in 1985 of the motel and the trailer park, which made Paulette extremely happy. And I was the principal of the school, and we'd go in as soon as spring hit, school ended, and the school year ended, we went into summer hours, which meant you could work. Well, actually, we took Fridays off and worked six-hour days. So by 2 o'clock, I was, you know, done working. Pretty easy to go fishing, you know.
Sure. So I'm with you. A lot of times I duck out of here and go in the afternoon. Sure.
Well, then thinking back, finding ponds and not finding fish. And then not knowing where the ponds were really, other than following the map, and you could follow the map, you know, and all that. So I decided maybe what I should start doing as a hobby is I'm going to measure the depth and decide arbitrarily that you need 8 feet of water, maybe 7 feet of water, to have a sustainable population of fish. In this massive area, which included, because it's not just at one chunk of ground out there, you've got 120,000 acres, and within it is within the boundary, so to speak, about 80,000 private land, ranch land. In this area, ultimately, I counted 200 bodies of water that could sustain a bass population. And then with bass, you typically want perch, or maybe bluegills, or maybe all three,
mm-hmm.
or maybe crappies. And people, it isn't that people hadn't stocked fish or planted fish or put fish in. There was even one large body of water that had a sustainable population of northerns. There was one where walleye were tried, but I'd never ever caught a walleye in it. The one with northerns, fabulous experience, great fun in that one. But, of course, this is all a little bit into the future. And so I started measuring and all that. So I decided, well, if I'm doing this and I can go over here and I know there's a nice population of fish, I can catch, you know, any number that I wanted to catch. Why don't I catch them and, you know, have pails with me and go and haul them over to the dam and dump them in. So I started doing that. I started I didn't do it in 1984, but in 85, I was moving along, and in that year, according to my record here, I caught and stocked 1,083 fish.
Wow.
And I still hadn't talked to anybody, hadn't, you know, so I'm out there doing this. I'm measuring ponds, catching fish, moving fish. Now, to do this, I had a blazer. I bought one in 1974. So this is 10 years later. I decided right away I got to get in the water. I can't do it from the shore. So I bought a bass tracker. You know, bass boats were becoming popular. Bass tracker led the way, followed by Coleman. The bass tracker one I bought, I wore that out. In fact, you had to have the boat, you had to have an electric motor, you needed a battery, of course, your fishing gear. I wore the first three of those out, initially, so I ended up buying a Coleman, which was better. You know, they came out in, I think, 86 with a new boat, maybe it was 87. And that was the one that you guys, in the photo, that's the one. So I built this frame, would push it in, you know, lift it up, push it in, pull it out. My dock was, of course, I also sent you a photo of what a grassland pond looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dock was a board that was, I think it was a 1x8, 1x10 probably. So I laid that out over the mud because the cattle were in there. And of course they walk up to the shore and drink and they're up to them from the creek shore. And of course they walk in everything. So you had to have something you could stand on as you launched your boat. Otherwise you're up to your ankles in mud usually. So that was my dock. So that's what the equipment I had to have was, my live well was a wire bag that you attached to the side of the boat.
Okay.
So if I was ready to go out and fish for bass, that's what I all had. And then you catch your fish, take them out, put them in a 5-gallon pail, I had 4 5-gallon pails that I could squeeze into the back of the Blazer, and then drive as fast as I could to this stand that I knew I was going to. And you could put, I put a 25 in a pail, so I could haul 100 at a time. Well, obviously, when you're doing that, you're overbagging.
Yeah.
So.
I was going to say, well, yeah.
Yeah. And I got to thinking, you know, so somewhere along the line, somebody's going to, you know, wonder a little bit more about this. And so So I decided finally in 87, in 86, I did 1,234 fish. So at this point, I'm up to 2,300. I decided I better go talk to Bob. Bob Hatton he must have worked for George, I suppose. But he was the fisheries specialist. He was in charge. And I sent you a copy of the letter that he wrote giving me authorization to stock dams, which means, he said, carry this letter because if a CO stops you, you know, obviously if you're hauling 100 fish, you're going to be a little over, you know.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
And so he wanted me to be protected. Well, I'd already been doing this by that time. I had hauled fish in 85 and 86, so I'm doing this in 87. 87 was a big year because I stocked 4,101 fish. So that was a big year. But that was also the year I went to David Beard, who was the, in charge of the grasslands, which is owned by the U.S. Forest Service, so he was a Forest Service employee. But the fish and wildlife are under the control of the state. So with Bob Hatton being in charge of fisheries for the state of South Dakota and David Beard being the U.S. Forest Service guy on the for the grasslands, but at that point I had permission, so to speak. In fact, not only did I have permission, the Forest Service put in effect a contract, so I was all of a sudden I was working for them as a volunteer. And that meant some money and fishing tackle. They gave me, I think it was maybe $1,000 a year for 3 years. And so I had, you know, okay. What I was doing was now legal. But they also gave me, in the summer of 87, they gave me the use of a pickup. And in the pickup was a large aerated water tank. So the process then changed a little bit. I needed someone else to help come with me to drive the pickup or drive my Blazer. But the first thing you had to do is go down to the you know, into the Bad River area where it comes into Missouri by pail. We didn't have a pump. So you had to buy pail, five-gallon pail, to lift the water out of the lake, put it in the container in the back of the pickup, and then you go.
What a pain that must have been.
But it would enable you. One day, I sent a photo of you to you. One day we caught 500 fish, you know, and of course I had a friend with me, so we were both out there. We're both in my boat. We're both fishing. We caught all these fish, and then you didn't have to go drive that fast because you have this aerated. Every time I had that, and I had it, you know, you had aerated tank, so you could go here, you could put 50 here and 100 there, and disperse 500 as opposed to dispersing 100. So this is carrying it out, you know, to the nth degree, perhaps. Well, in all, I continued through 1989. And we stocked. I caught during that period of time 13,883 fish, bass, almost all bass, perch are included in that. We stocked 88,791. I stocked. That I didn't have help more than a few times do that. And
that's incredible.
It's crazy. It is.
That's like 13,000. That's incredible.
I stocked 117. I measured 200. I didn't send you a copy of the award that I was given from the Forest Service. I intended to, and I didn't. Anyway, so I had just this little plaque. And on it, they recognized me for 1,000 hours of work out there for stocking, for measuring 200 dams, for stocking 117 of them. With they didn't list the numbers. But, of course, I had all this. I'll just show you this. That's a summary. And you can see by year.
Wow. You are like the fish godfather.
Oh, boy.
That is impressive. Yeah. Arnold Levinson? Exactly.
And I had to keep track, you know, what Bob Hampton wanted was all that kind of data that's there, you know, and over the years. And listing the ponds. And, of course, I kept track of where I caught them. And what might be a good producing pond one year isn't so much the next year. So, I have a five-year span of time where you can track it. Okay. Also, during this same five-year period of time, what the Forest Service wanted me to do, because all this land was rented to ranchers.
Okay.
Okay, they were charged with the responsibility of maintaining all of the dams. Well, if they didn't, I became the rat. And I had to tell Dave, I said, well, in this particular quarter, this particular section of land, you know, so-and-so has it. The dam is, you know, usually it was muskrats. Muskrats have burrowed in. It's created a fissure, and that fissure needs to be addressed. The farmer or the rancher, I should say, is supposed to do that. They're supposed to come in and pack it and spend some time with it, you know, to maintain it. And if you don't, they'll break. All it takes is a wind and a few holes in the front, a face of a dam, and if there's enough water and it gets into these holes, it'll cause damage and you'll lose the dam over time. And some of them today, some have been, you know, even before the, you know, because I'm talking 40 years ago, even in the 90s, some dams were lost. Well, I remember more from the 2000s, and because I went back out a few times, even living here, but going back out and, you know, fishing, and some of them are going to a dam that was a good dam and all of a sudden is gone. Then also, sometimes on private land, the ranchers would decide to build a new dam. Well, so then I had to have permission from all the ranchers. I should have backed up. I had permission to do for the federal land, which is the grassland, but you had to have permission on the private land.
Sure.
which I got. And, of course, I got to know the ranchers pretty well. and all that. So they knew I was out there, and they knew that I was, I had this responsibility to sort of like report on them. And it wasn't, you know, it was a, usually in all cases, it really was a friendly discussion. They would say, yeah, I know, I got to do this, I got to fix this, I got to fix that, you know. So that worked out okay.
That's an amazing story. That must have been fun. Did you ever get, because you mentioned you had a special certificate that allowed you to overbag, which, by the way, for fishermen, that's kind of like, how do I describe it? That's like having like James Bond's license to kill. I'd get permission to do whatever I want to. I want to catch 50 walleyes, whatever. Now, I know you were doing it for that reason. But did you ever get pulled a CO come by and go, what are you doing?
Not once.
Really?
I told Bob that. I says, you know, you're telling me about the COs that are working out there and maintaining, you know, law and order and all that. I said, I'm out there 6 years and never saw one. And he was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. The only time I was asked to come to one of the state commissioner, Game Fish and Park commissioner meetings. I knew only one commissioner, not that it mattered. I just knew him in a social context. But anyway, while I was there, and part of it, what Bob intended to do, well, what he did was he wanted to talk about the grasslands and about this effort as though it were his, you know, and he was not identifying me. Well, then somebody that was there popped up and said, well, I understand you've got some guy out there and you've given him permission to catch all these fish and overbag, and he's depleting the population of bass and all this. And and Bob just says, to avoid any conflicts, what he told me afterwards, he just says, no, that's not true. And that was the end of it. So rather than proceed with what he was planning to do based on what he read as a criticism of the department, I suppose, I don't know, he chose not to address the issue. It's just, you know, that was his choice, you know, of wording. What I was going to show you here was the extent of the green of all national grasslands.
Yeah.
And all my little marks are the different places where we went. So, Piers up over here.
Gotcha.
And Fort Pier. So, anyway. But yes, it was fun to do. It was a little bit of candy store time, you know. The fish weren't hard to catch, really, because they'd never been fished.
Sure.
Nobody had been out there fishing for them. So it wasn't like they were familiar with a lure. I ended up, of the large fish, the largest fish I caught was a 7-pound. I have that on the wall. I have a 5-pound. I had 4 pounds in that range. I had 9 that were 3.8 to 3.5, 27 that were 3 to 3.7, 26 that were 2.8 to 2.5, and 111 that were between 2 pounds and 2.7. Those are larger fish. You know, these are 7-pound, of course, is out there. State record at that point was 8 pounds. So I was within a pound of it as far as that goes. It got a little bit bigger. But there were thousands of fish that were in the 1 pound, or I'd say 6-8 ounces to a pound. That's really what you wanted to catch to go out and stock with. So,
great, anyway. Awesome. By the way, Caitlin has already gotten back to me.
Okay.
With and you too, because I copied you. So let me know how that turns out. Hopefully we'll get fingers crossed. Hopefully we can get your bugging museum listed.
Good idea.
And you could pay me royalties. No, I'm kidding. Just a joke. See you in a couple weeks, my friend.
All right.